You're listening to the Think, Live, Repeat podcast, a place for people who are looking for simple and actionable ways to bring their lives to the next level. I'm your host, John Skomski, and I want you to get ready for some amazing conversations as we dive deep into the minds of successful people, how they think intentionally and live differently. Here's just two simple rules. Change doesn't have to be complicated, and change begins with your mind. You literally possess the power to change the direction of your life. So consider yourself warned. If you're not ready to start growing today, you might just want to turn this off now before it's too late. Investors, it's another edition of the Think, Live, Repeat podcast. So glad you joined us. And today is an extra special guest because this man most likely is top three, like right up with my parents in terms of how much impact he has had on my life from like age 17 or 18 to present time. So I'm super honored not to just have somebody who's accomplished a lot and is changing the lives of so many people, but I can say from firsthand experience, he's literally changed my life and has continued to do so in like the most opportune times and ways. It's like all of a sudden, oh my gosh, he drops a gem. It pivots where I'm at. It changes my frame of reference, and I'm off until the next thing that we seem to connect over. So I actually found a list. Longest intro, by the way. We'll get to your name in a minute. I found a list the other day. This is before I started the podcast, of all of the guests that I wanted to have on. Like, and you know, they were, some of them were authors, some were speakers, musicians, athletes, and then I had my like close list. Like, these are the people who, you know, there weren't many people on it because, frankly, I guess I'm an out of touch person in that regard. But Jonathan Brush was on that list, and Jonathan Brush is here today. Jonathan, welcome.
Well, it's really cool to be here. We could come back at you and say that there's all kinds of things I've learned from you, and it's been really fun to go through this last couple of years together. We have hit at some interesting times. Sometimes I've been able to say, hey, I got something to help you out. Other times, John's called, like, how's it going? It's like, not so good, man. It's actually been a lousy week, a lousy month, and then we talk about some things that I get done and think, oh yeah, I feel a lot better about life. And so I've certainly really loved listening to your podcast, loved our association and friendship. And what a cool thing to be on this. This is a lot of fun. And what a humbling introduction. So I appreciate it.
Well, I just scratched my head as to why it took, you know, 80 or so episodes to happen. Maybe it was working up the courage. I don't know. But
I'm pretty intimidating. So
yeah, you do. You know, you got that intimidation
factor. I'm shorter than John, less good looking than John. Yeah, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, okay. That was the intimidation factor. Yeah.
Jonathan has an interesting pathway in his career, let's say, and he's done a lot. And in some ways, I would say he's pivoted in terms of like staying within the industry that he's in, but approaching it from a completely different angle. So he's promoted to a high level of responsibility and authority at a very young age, had a lot of just ability to shape people's futures and lives and the institution he was a part of, and then decided, hey, maybe there's a better way to do this. Maybe there's a different way, and joined a different company at that point. Big pivot for him. And that's when he and I, our paths crossed probably around 2010, and helped me get my first real job at that company. We did sales things. We were on the road together doing I was going to say seminars together trade show type stuff. And then we've kept up with it, you know, since then. So I'm going to let you take the mic because, for starters, just give people an idea of like where you started, what you're doing today, because that in itself is a very interesting tale. And then we'll pivot into some of the content that we want to cover today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks for the introduction. So I started, first of all, I came from a non-traditional education background. So I was homeschooled back when that was super weird. I didn't know anybody else who did it. And people were really worried about my overall educational abilities and social interactions. So you can judge whether either of those things worked well. That's, the jury's still out on that, depending on who you ask. But so then I went to college, did well in college, primarily because I was scared to death that I would embarrass my family by doing poorly after I was homeschooled. And so I graduated. College was a smashing success as far as I was concerned. I had graduated and I had a reasonable GPA. I also had met somebody who was a lot smarter and a lot more beautiful. And so she and I were scheduled to be married after graduation. So that just left a few sort of tiny little details like a job and place to live, you know, just those little
itsy been there.
Things. Yeah. And so the college said, hey, do you want to be an admissions counselor? And I had worked for the admissions office doing tours and stuff like that. And I was like, does it have a salary? And they're like, yeah. And I said, yes, I'd love to be an admissions counselor. And then, you know, signed all the paperwork and said, what's an admissions counselor? Like, like, how does that work? And so I did that for 2 years. And I guess the second year, they called me in, the vice president at the time, and he said, I'd like to make you the youngest director of admissions in the state. And I was like, I don't know what is wrong with you, but sure, I'll go with that. And so I did.
Does it come with a better paycheck?
Yeah, so that was actually a really good question. Yeah. And that was also like, yes, it does. Great. What do we do again? So that was kind of a fun little tagline to have. And I learned a lot. I had a great team, both of mentors and people in the office who put up with this young idiot coming in and trying to learn things on the job. And I did. And so there was some growing pains, but we did all right. And that went fantastic until about 2010. When I was like, you know, I am making a living asking people to make what I would consider to be a terrible financial decision. And that was just, I was watching, I loved my college, I loved my colleagues, but I was just watching people borrow at the time in 2010, $75,000 to get a degree in music.
It's cheap.
I'm like, man, I just can't, you know, I mean, like I'm just doing the math on this and I'm going, you can't get a job as a high school music teacher and pay this off in any time a reasonable time frame, and this is just crippling. So I ran across this little startup. They were doing something. They really ticked me off. I thought they were a scam. I called them, and I savaged the poor kid that answered the phone. And then the next 48 hours, all three co-founders called me back, and I told my wife, I said, I don't know who these people are, but I don't think they're a scam. And 6 months later, I went to work for them. And so I did some admissions work for them. They were doing an online college type thing, but it involved a lot of credit by exam and online courses at a time when that was really unusual. I started then a student life program for them. So about every 5 years, my job just radically changed. And then just through a whole series of what I can just only term as miraculous events in 2020, when there's nothing else going on, we acquired the company. and so the name of the company is Unbound. And I get to now do non-traditional kind of higher education. I help students do a bunch of different things, from certificates to earning degrees. They can do it while embedded in their local community, but then there's also a live event component that is a big deal for us. And I work with some really cool people. And yeah, along the way, one of those cool people was John, and we got to do some traveling together. And then he worked as a coach for some of our original programs, and now continues to help us. He teaches really cool financial stuff, like he talks about in this podcast, to our students. And so that's been kind of my strange, a little bit convoluted, totally unexpected journey. But I can honestly say that right now I'm doing something I never expected to be doing, and I'm really loving it. This is the coolest job I've ever had. These are the coolest people I've ever worked with. I got a great team. I got a great students, and it's been fun. It's been unexpected, but it's been fun.
There's so many reasons I love that narrative. Number one, because of the pivots, and I can relate to that. And it's so helpful because I almost, in some ways, I kind of dislike people who are like, I knew what I wanted to do when I was 18, and I, you know, and here I am, I'm 40, still doing it and getting better.
Yeah. I had a friend in college who knew he wanted to work for in intelligence, national intelligence, and then he went to school and he majored in everything. He loved it, and then went to master's program, loved it, and he's now highly placed in DIA and loves it. And I love him, but he's annoyed me my whole life because I'm like, man, what would it be like to have that kind of incredible certainty the whole way through? And John, I have been uncertain. I don't know that I've spent 6 months of certainty in my life professionally. There's been uncertainty about, like, am I in the right place? Am I in the right job? Is this the right position? Should I move? Should I not move? Should I stay? Should I not stay? Am I doing and now, as somebody who runs a company, am I doing the right things? Am I making the right decisions? I don't say that in like it's been a misery. It's just that it has been a lot of things, including fun and exciting, but certain has never been one of them.
Well, they say you got to get comfortable being uncomfortable. Maybe
I'm not there yet.
Well, neither am I, frankly. But also being uncertain, if that was an idea, because there's certain things you're just not going to be able to have pat answers for, and then you grow and adapt. So, going back to then your original story, because this is, I think, something I really want to dive into a bit here. You had this moment where you're like, oh my gosh, I'm selling $100,000 or at that time a $75,000 music degree, which is a steal by today's standards. Right. And you're like, I'm not sure about the cost benefit analysis. I'm not so sure this is a sound financial decision. I got to go home at night and look myself in the mirror and look at my wife and my kids and think, you know, I just signed up 3 kids to do this. Is this really the best thing? So you had this point where you're like, okay. So another way of saying that from my perspective would be, I no longer had confidence in what I was doing or delivering. In other words, there was an uncertainty. I want to stay with the certainty idea. There was an uncertainty that I was providing value. And I can say from firsthand experience, there's nothing more challenging and troubling than trying to sell or produce something that you're not 100% ironclad certain that there is value and that the value is far and away exceeding the price tag. So all that to say, how did you work through that value equation in your own mind? And how would somebody who's looking at what they're doing today, maybe they're like, gee, I just don't know if I'm producing value or if I feel great about this. How do you kind of move to the next step without completely just blowing up the whole thing?
Well, I don't know about the not completely blowing up the whole thing.
Or maybe you got to.
So that was kind of my tactic, and I'm not sure if that's the best tactic. To me, there was really a point where I arrived at a spot, and I was like, you're right. I did say, I think I'm making a living asking people to make bad financial decisions. But there was actually a couple of elements to that. One was just the sheer numbers. And two was I was no longer convinced that a college degree was doing what people thought it was doing, or that it was required to do what people thought they wanted to do. And so if you'll just permit a quick digression, because I think, you know, if your listeners should pay attention to this, if nothing else, because I think this is one of those, when you hear it, you can't unhear it and you go, wait a second, that makes some sense. And that is that, you know, for maybe all of human history, knowledge has been power. I mean, information's good, and information has been hard to come by. And I would say that even when I was in high school, which doesn't feel like that long ago to me, although the color of my hair is beginning to belie that, but if I didn't know something and my parents didn't know it and I didn't have books in my house that knew it, then I had to get in my car and drive to the library, which in my case was 35 minutes away, and I had to check out a book and I had to read it, and then I had to memorize that information and record it somehow. And if the library didn't have the book, I had to do something called interlibrary loan, which meant no, I wasn't going to do that. As a teenage boy, I had no ability to have to be that kind of organized. So therefore, acquiring new information was difficult. And getting better, I could drive, that was better. There was a library, that was better. But it was still the same problem that we'd had through all of human history. And so that meant that the whole calculus for getting a degree made sense. If you're a business, the people that have more stuff in their head gives you an advantage that's pretty significant. So you should definitely have more people around like that. Well, how do you know if they have more stuff in their head? Well, do they have letters beyond their name? Do they have a high school degree? Do they have a college degree? Do they have a master's degree? Do they have a PhD? And so those things all go together. There was an arms race there. The letters you had behind your name, you know, indicated that you had more information than not, right? So that meant it was easier and that you had some advantage. Now, that's totally different, right? So now we have, you know, these little computers we carry around in our pocket, and it has access to almost the entirety of the world's information. And so that means that there's been a change in the whole system in a way that's fundamental that most people don't understand. Now it's not about how much information you know, because really anybody has access to all the information. It's being able to ask the question that sorts that information and can use it correctly. And so colleges weren't doing that very well. They were on the old system. They're still in the old system. And so now that whole preamble was to say, I was having this real crisis because I was like, I'm selling something that's too expensive and it's not delivering what it says it is. And I make that whole distinction because, you know, you might be in a position where something's too expensive and you say, well, find a way to make it cheaper. But I was in a position where I was like, not only it's not about like more financial aid. It's like when you get the degree, it doesn't do what you think it does. And so what does it do? Well, it doesn't. People are like, well, I get a degree and then that prepares me to do a job. It doesn't. In fact, the new world system, you know, with information being so accessible, in many ways, getting in certain degree tracks, not all, and it's important to note that, but certain degree tracks, the loss of 4 years in a traditional college environment is just that. It's a net loss. And I'll use two examples. If you're going for an engineering degree, traditional degree is still a really, really good option. And so, and I'm totally in for that and a lot of support and excitement for that track for somebody. But if you're going for, say, a marketing degree, the people that are teaching you that marketing degree are so out of step with what is going on in the marketing world because the changes are so rapid, not because they're dumb people, but because the change is so rapid that even those of us in the middle of marketing stuff don't know what's going on, yeah, right?
The textbooks are out of date like within 3 months. Oh, like,
a year ago, some kid that was finishing a marketing degree after they'd been with us came to me and showed me the textbook, and the textbook's example of a social media platform was MySpace.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. I mean, so, and that's their up-to-date textbook, right? So, you know, you can pay a lot of money to go learn a lot of outdated information that is no longer relevant and then join a marketing firm where they're going to have to deprogram you from all the stuff you learned. Or if you're mildly interested in this stuff, you can join a marketing firm. They can teach you on the job, and it's going to be hard, but you're going to get paid while you do that, right? So that's the kind of changes I'm talking about, where you sort of have to do this little logical thing, say, am I actually in a position where I'm creating value, right? Is this actually, and my crisis was degrees were just simply not delivering the value that everybody thought they were. And so I think when you get to that point where you just, it's not just like, if I change this thing, it's fine, but you almost have a whole system where you go, boy, nothing in this system is delivering stuff the way I do. I think that's when you're maybe in a possibly need to light the fuse and blow it up situation.
So maybe we do, but yeah. So in that case, so that's an interesting iteration. So that is decision process number one. Is it merely a matter of price? Like, is the product itself sound? Is the experience, the service, whatever you're providing, is it merely a matter of price and or valuing, or is the end result no longer the most viable option? It's funny because I mean, we've worked at the same company at one point. I have never heard it related that way. I'm just sitting here thinking, oh my gosh, of course a degree in 1978 or 1965 or whatever was exceptionally more important, because especially if you lived in rural parts like, you know, West Virginia or Oklahoma, and you had one library that was 60 miles away or 30 miles or whatever, what were you going to do? Like, literally, how are you going to get that information? Well, you go to college and you get in and so forth. And then not just that, but now, like you said, the acceleration of everything, because everything is accessible on the phone right here. It's the speed at which you information changes is greatly accelerated, because it's constantly being tweaked and updated in 24/7.
And it changes the way business is done, John, because, for example, in the past, planning was paramount. So if I'm going to launch a big product, I'm going to spend a lot of money in focus groups, a lot of money in market research. I'm going to do a lot of planning. I'm going to get my production ramped up. I'm going to get the people lined up. I'm going to get my contract set up. You know, I might spend 3 or 4 years planning something before I spend the first dollar. Because when I spend the first dollar to launch my widget, I'm going to spend all my dollars to launch the widget, and I'm going to expect the widget price to return it. A lot of business today is replaced with iterative decision making, where I'm going to launch a website for practically nothing and sell a widget that I haven't even produced. And if I get a lot of people interested in it, I'm going to do a crash run and produce it fast as an on-demand thing and have it shipped on demand and get it to my customers almost instantly. And so that is transferred to everything else. So it's like, if you're in a situation where I think and think and think and I put a lot of things together and I get really systematic about it, the market's gone. I mean, the market's changed. I mean, it's past you. And so you're in a situation where you have to try and fail, and you have to get in and do this, and you have to ask questions, and you have to test this. Didn't work, didn't work, did work. Didn't work, didn't work, did work. Didn't work, didn't work, does work. That kind of thing. And that's a different mindset. That requires a capacity to deal with failure. It requires a capacity to be flexible. It requires you to think differently. And honestly, it's a system that is not reflected in our current educational processes, really from kindergarten through college, where failure is fatal. You know, get a bad GPA, can't get into college, can't graduate. And then you get out in a world where failure is necessary for you to be able to figure out even the smallest thing, because the person that hired you probably hasn't the foggiest idea. I mean, John, you run a business. I hire people constantly who do stuff that I don't even understand. Like, I understand what I'm done, but you know, when I'm talking about somebody who's going to write code for my website, I know that needs to be done. I don't know how to do it. And so that's the norm. Most people are hiring folks that they don't know what they're doing. And so that kind of iterative decision-making process is reflective of the fact that we're now in a questions-based paradigm versus an answers one. And all of that requires somebody to be able to really focus in on, say, where am I actually creating the value? It's not about an easy sort of like, I have a degree and I'll trade my degree knowledge for your money. It's more like, if I'm hiring somebody, it's like, I'm hiring you and paying some money. How is it that you're going to produce more value for me than the money I'm paying you?
Well, so let's get right into that. So how do you filter in your own, and just from your own experience in working through a lot of different business models, both the traditional education and the kind of that I would call it hybrid startup company, and then what you're working on now with Unbound. How do you personally, what lens or lenses do you view the value creation process? How do you know if you're creating value? How do you define value? What's you know, from a monetary standpoint, like how do you both do good and do well by doing good? Those are kind of, I think, questions a lot of people grapple with, especially if they're just kind of, they've gone through the motions, they've gone to traditional school, they went to traditional college, they got the traditional job, they're paying their traditional student loans. It's very hard to sort of kind of waken from the matrix, as it were, and start to think outside the box, which is really what is required in a lot of ways to start to create more than usual amounts of value and more than usual amounts of wealth, or however you want to define success. So walk us through those lenses, Jonathan's lenses, and how we could take some broader application from that.
Yeah, so I find it helpful to sort of first, like, what are the subconscious things that's running my brain that I'm not thinking about? And I think from years and years of dealing with parents and students who are in this process of going from like high school to college, from, I'd say, sleeping on their parents' couch to sleeping on their own couch, that there's some things that are subconscious that everybody's running that I think we should question. And one of those is, everybody's like, why are you doing all this stuff? Well, I want to be successful. Sometimes they say it just like that. Sometimes they say it in some other ways, but it's all this sort of reflection of, what does it mean to be successful? And then that's the question. What does it mean to be successful? Well, if you press people, the best they can come up with usually is some version of rich, famous, or powerful. And some of them are highly ambitious. They want to be the next Jeff Bezos or President of the United States or something like that. But a lot of them are just like, if I could be as rich, famous, as powerful as my parents, or maybe a little more, that would be some definition of success, right? Or more than I am now. And so, first of all, let me just state that, you know, I'm not against any of those things necessarily. I just know from long experience and from, you know, reading other people's experiences, that if you pursue those things for those things, you are almost always going to wind up empty inside. Mm. That there's never enough wealth, there's never enough power, and there's never enough fame to scratch that itch. And so you have to go about it in some other way. So what does it mean? What is it you're really after? For us in Unbound, we teach our students, you know, the question is, how do you thrive? And so two things that are relevant here. The first is, we tell folks, like, look, to move forward in the world, you have to be a good manager of your time and a good manager of your tasks. There's going to be not enough time to do all the tasks that you need to do in this world because of the information explosion we have. So people that can manage both are great. But time and tasks only make sense in the context of relationships. And so you have to think in terms of, how do you connect these things to other people? I can be the best time manager in the world, and if everybody thinks I'm a jerk, it doesn't matter. I can be the best task manager in the world, and if I don't take into account the people I'm working with, for, and around, then it doesn't matter what I get done. And so that context then lets us ask the next question, which is, what is it that you actually do that pays the bills? And the answer to that is, create value. And it's specific in that you say that instead of, I earn more than I spend. I have a good margin. I have those things all become then these ways to measure stuff that end up kind of making you empty and that you don't understand. So maybe I stumble onto a job that I'm really good at and I make more money and I've got a great bank account. And then that job gets obliterated by technology. And now all of a sudden I'm burning my money and I have no idea because it felt like an accident that I stumbled into it the first time. Or, you know, I have a friend recently who invested a long time with a big Fortune 500 company, and they just told him recently, yeah, good, see you, guy. Bye. And 2 decades are gone, and he's like, man, I don't even have a lot of contacts because I spent the last 2 decades busting my tail for these people, thinking this was kind of where I was going to finish up, and now they don't need me, and I don't know what to do next, right? And so creating value sort of strips away the monetary piece and says, at the end of the day, you have to do something that somebody else says, yeah, that's good. Like, yeah, like I want that. I need that. That hits something that is deep inside of me. And when you do that, then two things are happening. You get paid for that, but also it's something useful. And you don't get trapped in these things where, like, you know, I had an association with a company one time where, you know, they basically created value by eliminating the competition. You know, in other words, they didn't do a good job. What they created was actually inferior and stupid and didn't work very well, but they were big enough that they just obliterated anybody that tried to threaten them. Well, that works for a time, right? I mean, when you've got the horsepower, but eventually you get destroyed by that, right? And not only that, but the people that work for their soul gets destroyed. You know what I mean? Yeah. Because, you know that what you're doing doesn't make sense. And so I think to be able to ask that question and say, all right, you know, if you're a young person starting out, and you're going to create value, what's your value? Well, I sweep the floor for this business owner, so he should pay me because I'm working for him. No. You swept the floor for that business owner. It's valuable to the business owner because they don't like sweeping the floors, or the time that they don't have to do sweeping the floors, they can do something that's more valuable. That it's not super complicated, but there's a tremendous gap between those two things. I'm sweeping the floors. You hired me. You owe me a job. You now owe me wages. Not untrue, but not the truth. It's true, but it's not the whole truth, right? Mm-hmm. The better understanding of that is, I swept the floor. you don't like sweeping the floor, so you don't have to do that. That's valuable. Also, you spent time making new sales calls. That's valuable for the company. Also, the customer came in and the floor was clean, and so that gave them a good impression of everything. That's valuable. So I created value for the customer, clean floors. I created value for the owner, don't have to sweep the floor. I created value for the owner, have more time to create sales. That creates more value for the company. People that have just that little linkage to be able to go, oh, I'm creating value. All of a sudden now, you can, that is true whether you're a CEO or a first-time worker. That attitude, that perspective changes everything. It's not about how well I sweep floors. It's about how well I perceive where the value is, and then what can I do to influence that? How do I create value for the people around me? Figure that out, and it doesn't matter what you're doing.
That right there is it's got to be a primary key to this whole retention, quiet quitting, $20 minimum
absolutely.
Wage.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All of these things, like not getting political, but just saying straight up, because you look and it's never, you should never do this because it's terrible for your mental health. But if you choose to, anyways, as I've done in the past, will you read through the comments on posts about like the $20 minimum wage or quiet quitting or this and that? You get two very distinct, just this is broad brushstrokes here, groups of people. One is the people who are doing the work and approach it from a, I'm going to call it a consumer mindset in your language, in your reference, what you just did is basically, I do work, you owe me money. Right. Me worker, you pay me money. Or you have the other group that is either a business owner or approaches their job from a business owner, entrepreneurial mindset, which then says, like you're talking about, I'm creating value and it's all about value because the money, I think you've had Derek Kinney on your show. Derek was my first guest. I don't know if he coined it or someone. He's like, the money flows where the value goes. And so when you're creating value and you understand the exchange of value, like you're saying, then the money part is a lot easier and you're going to be more vested in it because now there's an exchange of there's more than merely it's an owing of something. It's a mutual beneficial relationship rather than almost adversarial, which is what a lot of companies end up being. I mean, that's so brilliant.
That last part is so important. I mean, like, because if you create value for somebody, you have to be able to, it can't be obscure. You have to go, oh, this makes sense. Like it has to be an almost immediate. Yes, I want that and if it's not immediate or if it's like, well, I'm creating value for me. You know, mm-hmm. like if you're selling somebody something and you're not telling them everything about it, it's a bad match for what they want. They don't really need it. And you manage to arm twist them into buying it. Did you create value? Well, you created value for one person in that exchange, you. And can you do that? Yes. Can you get rich doing that? Unfortunately, yes. That's why being rich, famous, and powerful can't be our standard for success, right? Can you thrive doing that? No. Eventually, A, it catches up to you. Second, it'll eat your soul, man. Like, I mean, at some point, you're going to be empty and hollow inside and not know what you're doing. But this isn't like you have to then work for a nonprofit or you have to go, you know, do refugee resettlement. I mean, you don't have to get into some sort of like charity work to have fulfilling work. Not that there's anything wrong with those things. It's just that it's not necessary to go there. It's necessary for you to say, creating value means I do something for somebody and they want it. And they exchange value with me for the thing that they want. I met a need that they have, and they're like, great, I needed that. So when I go get my oil changed, look, I grew up working on my cars because I was too poor to do anything else. And so I can change the oil in my car, and I can do it for less money than the oil change place. But there's a place called Take Five. It's an actual business, a chain in my place. And you drive in, you don't even get out of the car and they do it. Not only that, the guys are funny. They joke around. They're upfront. You know exactly what you're paying. It cost me probably 30% more to get my oil change there, but I don't have to buy the filter. I don't have to come home and do it. I don't have to crawl underneath the car anymore in the middle of January. I pull in and 5 to 10 minutes later, I pull out smiling because those guys are joking around with my oil change. So is that valuable to me? Yes. Is it valuable to them? Yeah, I'm paying them good solid money for it, right? Yeah. I mean, like both of us are happy. And so did it lead to some human flourishing? Yeah, they made money to feed their family and I got something done faster that gives me more time to spend with my family. I'm really happy with that exchange. And so nobody's taking advantage of anybody there. You know, that this is a mutual thing where value is being traded. And, you know, there's an infinite, you know, my belief system as a Christian says that I believe in people being made in the image of God and God created everything. And so there's an infinite creativity available. And whether you're a Christian or not, I think you can probably look around and say, yeah, that makes sense. In the sense that, you know, there's always ways to create value. And so economy's good, the economy's bad. The government's doing something, the government's not doing something. You know, there's whatever going on. Those things are hard. I'm not making them, I don't mean to say that that's not hard stuff to adapt to, but the base gravity still works. You know, no matter what this system is, somebody still needs things of value. And so when you are somebody who says, I know how to create value, doesn't matter what the economy does, doesn't matter what the regulations are, doesn't matter what those people find a way. And I'm not always good at it. I'm not saying it's easy, but I just know that it's the thing that will let you A, constantly be relevant, and B, be able to help people as you help yourself. So it's a win-win situation.
So if someone's looking at this and saying, okay, great, I agree with that. Because again, it's that mutual exchange, and then it's no longer one-sided and adversary. It's a mutual exchange of value. The car oil changing was that's perfect. It's an excellent example of it. So what if they're sitting there saying, okay, I agree. Makes total sense. Where do I start? Like, how do I decide, like, what if where I perceive value isn't in my education or my experience? Like, do I do a total pivot? Like, you and I both know what that's kind of like. Like, what are just some practical things that come to mind when it's like, okay, where do I start? I want to actually take what you just said, take it from head to actually heart and hands and put it into practice. And then that's going to tie into then the timeline of all of this, which is how long does it actually take to create long-term,
great,
consistent, sustainable value? But for starters, where do you start?
Well, I think you start wherever you are. So that's the first thing. This is not like I have to go get another education. I've got to go do. So we teach our students at Unbound that they're trying to do two things, and you do it by one thing. So the two things you're looking for is, no matter what situation you're in, you're looking to build more skill and to gain more experience. And that's true, especially if you're 18. It's also true if you're 58, right? So, I mean, you're looking to build more skill and experience. Well, how do you do that? Well, we teach our students to do that by having an attitude of mastery. And what we mean by that is that whatever you're doing, find something, whatever you're doing, and saying, I would be willing to try to do this better than everybody else around me. Not as a competition, just as a, what am I going to lean into and figure out how to do this? And that gives you a drive. It gives you a purpose. It gives you a way to kind of lean in and say, okay. And so lots of times I'm working with younger students, right? So they're working at some fast food place like Chick-fil-A. And I say, okay, well, great. You know, what do you want to get good at? Well, they like to work in the front of the store because they like to interact with people. All right, so you have a chance to have an attitude of mastery and say, I'm going to be the friendliest person at Chick-fil-A, which is a pretty high bar, right? Yeah, but also there's no industry in the world that doesn't need people that can relate in a friendly way to their customers in a high-stress, fast-moving environment. So that's going to have massive value for you in terms of you being able to do that and understand that. While you're doing that, you're asking that question, what is the real value that I'm creating here? And then long term, what happens is people end up trading skill for autonomy. The better you are at whatever you do, the more people will let you decide how to do it. And lots of research shows that people that can choose the way they do things are happier. Secondly, the more experience you have, the more you figure out what the world needs and the more you figure out what you do and how those things cross. And so when you find yourself in a place where you're doing something where you get to choose how to do it and you think it makes a difference in the world and it pays your bills, lots of research says that's where you find work that you love. Now, here's the last piece of that. You don't do that in 6 months. You don't do that in a year. You don't do it in 3 years. And you don't do it in 4 years. My experience is it generally takes people 10 to 12 years on the front end of their career, and then a lot less, you know, if they're coming to this late and trying to make a pivot because they already know a lot of these things. And so I tell young people all the time, like, chill out. There's a big difference. And here's the example I use, John. If I'm, and sorry, Walmart, but if I'm stocking shelves at Walmart, you know, that's not exactly an aspirational
job. There goes the sponsorship.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry, John. But, you know, it's like stocking shelves at Walmart is fine. I'm not belittling the work. It's just most people don't aspire to do it as a career, right?
Right.
So if you're stocking shelves at Walmart and you think that's all you're going to do for the rest of your life, life's fairly miserable, right? I mean, you're just kind of like, I'm in a dead-end job. But if I decided that what I really want to do with my life is I want to sail around the world, and every time I get paid for my shift stocking shelves at Walmart, I'm like, that is money in the bank that's going to pay for sailing lessons in a boat. Well, then all of a sudden, you have purpose and a drive and a fervor to do that. And stocking shelves at Walmart may not be fun, but you're real excited because you're getting somewhere. And so if you have this concept that, like, whatever I'm doing, I'm building skill and I'm gaining experience, and then I will trade that skill and that experience for autonomy and work that makes a difference, and that will be work that I love and that will create value for people and that will be fulfilling to me and make a difference in the world. When you know that that's the progress process that you're on, then all of a sudden it changes everything, right? Because now it's not just a dead end job. It's a job that you're making. You can see and feel progress. You know you're moving forward. And so, yeah, if it takes you 10 years to get there, it'll be 10 increasingly good years. I'm not saying you have 10 years of suffering. I'm saying you have 10 years of increasing responsibility and increasing understanding that leads to more and more autonomy and more experience. And ultimately, and along the way, you might be like me and say, this isn't creating value. I need to make a big pivot. But now, instead of just like randomly going, I hate my job, I'm going to do something different. You go, nah, I don't, it's not that I hate my job. I understand that my job's not delivering value. And I understand that I could deliver value over here. It's now time to go. And so, you know, there's a lot of peace that comes with that versus a, I'm going to jump and hope that I hit the bottom correctly and don't break anything to like, oh yeah, I now know this does not make sense. It's time to do something else.
So I've always had this in my mind, this kind of paradigm, either or, meaning there are people, these lucky so-and-sos who find, they literally love what they do. Like, find a job you love. You never work a day in your life.
Oh, I hate that.
And yeah, I hate those freaking people. and then there's a large group of people who, in other words, finds a job that doesn't suck, that they can stomach, but they use whatever they make from it to then go sail around the world, hunt, you could take family vacations, do like ministry missions, like whatever. Like, I've always just thought there, and then there are those who just don't care and literally are just living for the weekend to do what they do. And then they just kind of go through this slow, vicious cycle. So I guess there's three really. Would you agree with that assessment, or is the people that we all hate, the ones that say they've, you know, never work a day in their life, are they really just maybe poorly expressing the idea that you said a moment ago, which is finding, you know, a job? And I want you to actually reiterate that. You said, if you can do it on your own terms and you know you're creating value and you're paying your bills, like, is it really just that? And they've just framed it a little bit differently? Or are there these few precious people who like, oh my gosh, I'm not working. Like, you think of an athlete, or you think of like an actor or something, like a singer. Like, if I was singing and on stage of 100,000 people, of course I'd, you know, never work, making millions and millions of dollars. I'd never work a day in my life. So can you speak to that? Like, I don't know, any false dichotomy possibly, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. I'm holding on my desk so I don't kind of flip out here. So
okay. Hang on.
I have extremely strong opinions about this. So if you're listening, just brace yourself.
Let's go.
so I think that find a job you love, you other than work a day in your life, it's a big, huge pile of stinking garbage. It is absolute total trash. And the people who say it are well-intentioned idiots. Okay. So when I tell my students, when you hear people say that, smile and nod because they're well-intentioned, and don't believe anything about it, and don't take any more advice from that person. And so there's I think we're running into something here on the two extremes. You've got people that are saying that because they're like, dang it, if I had just skateboarded more when I was 16, Red Bull would be paying me right now, right? But they think of that, and it's a defense mechanism. If I had done something back then, I would be cool now, but I didn't. And that therefore gives me an excuse to suffer now and not have to do the hard work to change. And they don't think of that consciously. They're not actually thinking that, but that's what's going on subconsciously. And that's not, it's not that they are worth less as a person. It just means that they don't have much option to change that because they're locked in a poor attitude, right? So we don't want them to part of that. The other side is a fighter pilot syndrome. And so see if this makes sense to you. You get somebody who flies F-18s off a an aircraft carrier, and they say their job is awesome. And most of us look at that and say, yeah, I mean, it beats washing dishes in the bottom of the aircraft carrier, right? Okay. And so they get on stage because that's really cool. And they say, look, people, here's what happens. Go to work, work hard, do your studies, dream big, and you can be like me. That's garbage. That's complete crap. Because like, yeah, you can be like you. You got straight A's, and then you happen to be in the place and the time where you got the appointment to the Naval Academy. Not everybody gets that. And then you got to the Naval Academy, and you happen to do really good again, good on you. But it also turned out that genetically, you didn't pass out when they put you in the spinny thing. That's the thing. You can be perfect and you can have a genetic disposition that says you pass out when you go through high G's and you can never fly fighter planes, even though you're a straight A student and everything else is perfect, right? Well, then you did that and you entered the Navy just when they needed people to fly F-18s and not C-130s. I don't think the Navy flies C-130s, but anyhow, they didn't fly the transport planes, right? Yeah. King Airs. And so good on you, but that's not up to you. That was right? And so like you worked hard, fantastic, but you also happened to hit all the right timing. And at the end of the day, only 1% of 1% of people fly F-18s off of flight decks. And that's awesome, but you're a freaking anomaly. And so I'm glad that you do that, and I'm glad that you're happy. But the idea that everybody can work hard and do the same thing you did is completely ridiculous. And so, and you can insert that in there for anybody who's a rock star and all this stuff. But also there's another aspect of it. You know, flying F-18s is awesome until you get shot down. I mean, like, you know, I mean, being
there's
a rock
star. That minor detail, yeah.
Right. Being a rock star is awesome until you can't go anywhere without a bodyguard because the stalkers are after you. I mean, being an athlete's great, except for you're constantly worried about a crippling injury and you get sold like meat, you know, and like you never have any kind of job security and your whole family may have to move across the coast because, you know, you got traded in the deal, right? Or you got a new coach and you hate him. I mean, like, there's always work involved in anything, right? So there's no place where you go where it's like, oh, it's a vacation every day. That's just ridiculous. And so we have these two extremes. One end are people that are well-meaning but don't want to do anything different. And the other side is people that are anomalies. They have fighter pilot syndrome. And I think that there's a third alternative here, which is, no, it's not hard to figure this out. If you can choose what you do and you do something that makes a difference and you can pay your bills, all the studies and my personal experience shows that people are actually quite happy, and it almost doesn't matter what you do. So wherever you are, you have now the ability, you have you're in charge of your destiny. Build more skill and gain more autonomy, gain more experience, and find out what you can do that makes a difference in the world. Almost always your income goes up when that goes along, and you'll find yourself in a position where you really like it to. Look, man, I was riding steeplechase horses in high school and thinking that that was a really cool thing to do. And it was a cool thing to do. And I wound up behind a desk doing education stuff, which sounded dry as dust to me and not at all interesting. And yet here I am 20 some whatever years forward. And this is way more exciting to me than it ever was falling off of horses. And that wouldn't make any sense to 18-year-old me. But I'm good at what I do and I'm the boss now. For better or worse, I can decide what I do every day. And what I do definitely changes the lives of the students in my program.
Oh, yeah.
And so, man, yeah. I get up every day and pinch myself and be like, I can't believe I do this, right? But, you know, at 18, 25, 35, this didn't make any sense to me at all, right? I mean, like, I had no idea what I was looking for, you know, the fighter pilot job. And so that's the exciting thing. Every industry has this. I know people in everything you can imagine that love what they do, but they all have those characteristics. And I think that's exciting, like, it's 100% possible to like what you do. It's worth going after because you'll do better at it. And if you do better at it, you'll create more value. If you create more value, I think you make the world a better place. That's a pretty good deal.
It's like we need to get masterclass on the line here, because this right there.
Well, there's a sponsor.
There's a sponsor. Yeah, forget Walmart. Nobody's teaching this in high school. Nobody's teaching this in middle school. Nobody's teaching this in college. Nobody's teaching this at places of employment. You either find someone. You want to talk about the odds, someone like yourself, there's not many people saying that. I can highlight that because I consume a lot of content. In fact, I've been on the receiving end of this conversation because I have taken in some incredibly, we'll call it fighter pilot individuals in different, you know, in business and in motivation, all these things. I'm looking at them like, what the is wrong with me? Like, where am I going with this? Why do I not love what I do as much as they love what they do? And then you start thinking, you go down that dark path of, well, if I was doing what they were doing, then I'd be. And then it's this if then. So you delay happiness, you delay satisfaction, you let other areas of your life suffer, relationships, all that stuff, to try to get to that. And then even if you do, like you said, to your point, you find out it's not what you thought it was, or you don't ever, you just keep chasing it when it was right in front of you all along. And so this needs to be heard by so many people, young and old, because it would be life-changing, absolutely life-changing. And to that point, and I want you to speak, because this is probably the most recent conversation you and I have had in the past that I think was so impactful for me, and it ties in perfectly. It's like we planned this. Talk about the time factor, right? So this whole idea of creating value and finding a job, and you have some level of autonomy and you're creating value and you can pay the bills, you can do it, and it doesn't happen in 6 months,
right?
And so two things, because you can go on Instagram right now and you're going to find some 18-year-old such and such.
Fighter pilot. That's, anomaly.
Yeah, fighter pilot.
Yeah.
That made $1 million before he graduated his freshman college, and you can do it too. Take his class for $99.99 and then boom, right? So you're inundated with this. And you and I'm speaking like I, and I feel like in my 30s, I'm late to the party. I've screwed up. I'm a failure, you know, whatever. So talk about the time component of this, because you also talked about that idea of if you're 30 or 40, it's not like you have to like be 20 again. There's right. this bending of the curve. So talk about the bending of the curve. Talk about the time it takes to actually learn some of these things, because we give up too soon. I give up too soon. So many people give up too soon. So help us.
Yeah. So, well, that last part about bending the curve, so many people hear this and say, oh, well, I should have gone back and done all these things differently, and it would take me blah, 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 so long. Like, or somebody say, I started a business. I spent 5 years trying to make the business work. The business didn't work. I don't want to start all over. I don't have another 5 years to spend the business. Well, you won't spend another 5 years. You spent 5 years learning a ton of transferable stuff. And almost everything you do to start the second business is going to be easier because you've already learned those things, maybe through failure, maybe through success. And so, you know, even if you've done something totally different, there's huge amounts of transferable skills, right? So you've driven a truck all of your life, and now you want to go write books. Okay. And it's like, well, now that's transferable. Yeah, it is. You've got a whole lifetime of experiences and a lifetime of stories and a lifetime of, you know, like that shortens the curve on the other side. And so all experience is cumulative, and most experiences are transferable in some ways. Clearly there's certain specialized skills in certain areas, but most people underestimate how much of their skill will transfer. So that's one. Secondly is this idea that, so yeah, beware anomalies, right? So yeah, there's always the 18-year-old, But the other side is like, what did it cost that person? And I know this is going to sound crazy to your listeners, but I've always had a deep sadness for Tom Brady. And I don't know Tom Brady, right? But I remember seeing, you know, so I'm about the same age as Tom Brady. But I remember thinking, golly, what would it be like to not be 30 and have won all these Super Bowls and have all these top things? Like, in other words, I'm at a point where I'm looking forward to many more years of learning and succeeding. And this guy's looking at stuff going, at a certain point, I cannot run fast anymore, and nothing in my life will be as cool as what's going on right now. Now, I don't think that that's actually true, but I think that's what everybody tells him. That's what probably he tells himself, right? And so, like, there's no wonder it took so long to retire, because what could possibly match that on the other end? It ain't doing the stupid Hertz commercials that make me want to never rent from them again, right? And so the point here is that there has to be something different. This is my personal experience. So I try to make a really clear distinction between the research says and my personal experience says. So I don't have any research on this. This is just my observations as a person. So your results may differ. Everybody that I know who was super successful early paid a really big price someplace else. And so I have a very close friend who became the CEO of a really big company that was his big desire. And he made it in like his very early 30s, late 20s. And he has told me on numerous occasions, he said, that was great. It almost cost me my wife. It did cost me a lot of relationships with my kids. I've rebuilt relationships with my community and stuff like that, that took me decades to straighten back out. And so he said, it is not good to be king before you have been knighted. It's not good to jump from groom to the throne. And can you do it? Yes. And in certain circumstances, is that considered a blessing? Possibly. Just understand that it comes with things that you have to pay, because there are things that you ought to learn in order. And if you jump over them, you'll still have to learn them, but they're harder to learn from the other side. And so I tell my students, like, you know, 0 to 22, people are trying to figure out how life's going. Makes sense, right? But then like 22 to 35, you're trying to figure out how to apply it. And that's a long span. It ain't 4 years of college. It's a long span. And then 35 to 40, you're like, okay, now I know how this works. Now how do I figure out how to put it into action? And then 40 to 50 or 55 is generally people's most productive years of increasing production. And then 55 to like 65, people are generally killing it. And then 65 on is a turning around and giving back to the next generation. And each of those phases are distinct, and each of those phases are very rewarding in their own. And they work better if they come in order. Now, are those numbers precise? No, that's a combination of experience and some research, and you could split them a couple different ways. But what I think is not arguable is that it's a much longer span than you think, going from I know how life works to I know how to work life, you know, that 20 to 35-ish something. And then, you know, like, well, I'm 45 and I'm not sure that I'm killing it. That's fine. Don't panic. But you've also got a ton of life experience. So go back to what we said before. When you start to figure these things out and put them together, you know, a 25-year-old still has a ton of experience that won't let them, a lack of experience that won't let them make that work, right? You at 45 will be able to do it tomorrow, because you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. I've been here before and seen this pattern before. And so I just tell people, like, don't envy those folks that get there too fast. They may look really happy on Instagram. Everybody does. But they're likely paying big costs that you can't see. And, you know, don't envy that. Instead, trust that where you are is where you need to be. Understand these things. Look for how to create the value. Look to build skill. Look to gain experience. Ask these questions. Don't be afraid to make the changes. Recognize that you can do it. And, you know, doing it in order tends to lead to really fulfilling lives. I'm determined that each year is going to be better until I'm dead. And then in my worldview, it gets even better after that, right? And so I had a wonderful time in high school, riding horses and all that kind of stuff. I really enjoyed college. I had a great early young adulthood. I don't want to do any of it again. You couldn't pay me enough money. Everything about my life is better, except for I don't bounce nearly as well when I fall down. Like that's the only thing I miss. I'm not as fast, covering deep and ultimate, and I don't bounce when I lay out for a disc. Those are the things that are really problematic at this point. But everything else is way more awesome than that. Don't regret it. Wouldn't trade and do it again. And I'm looking forward to having kids is awesome. I heard that having grandkids is better. Can't wait. Right. And so I'm looking for an inward, upward, getting better type of situation.
Audience, I think by now you can kind of see why, you know, he's on speed dial. He's picking up the bat phone when I send up the signal, because the wealth of knowledge in it, I would say, and I think Jonathan, you would say this, that wealth of knowledge, your ability to off the cuff, literally just speak to all these very heavy hitting points, came from 20 plus years
right.
of getting knocked around. Right? Like, in other words, you, 25-year-old you, wasn't sitting in the admissions counseling office with prospective people saying
no,
this.
No, I was sitting there miserable trying to figure out what the world I'd done with my life. And that, you know, at 25, thinking it was all over because I wasn't an entrepreneur. And apparently you had to be an entrepreneur by 18 or it wasn't going to work. I thought stupid stuff like that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so this is a testament to the fact of the power of time. And so we'll wrap with this. So two-part question. If there's someone who is of student age, how do they engage? What's the next step? How do they learn more about Unbound? And for those of us who, you know, we're past college age, but obviously found a lot of value in what you just said, how do we engage? How do we stay in touch? How do we hear more?
Yeah, well, you can go to beunbound.us. So that's beunbound.us, and you can learn about us there. It's easy to get in touch with us. You can find us on social media, and we even do a Be Unbound podcast that you should only listen to after you've listened to all of John's. So if you're still listening to John's podcast, don't switch over until all the TLR is done, and then you can take a look if you're interested. And then I am not rich, famous, or powerful. And so that means that I'm still accessible. So if anybody has questions or a disagreement or anything like that, you can go to the website, find me, contact anybody at Unbound, and they'll give you my personal phone number. And be happy to talk and answer any questions. And if you are a young person, absolutely check out Unbound. We're not for everybody, but for the people we're for, it's an absolutely awesome experience. And right after we record this, John, a couple of days from now, we'll be flying to Colorado for our final live event for the year for our flagship program called Ascend. And, you know, look, I told somebody earlier today, it's a ton of work. I'll get no sleep. It's massive labor. We're going to be at high altitude, like all these kinds of things. And we're looking forward to it like it's Christmas, because the kids that we work with, the students we work with, are so amazing. Our team is so amazing. It literally, like, we're looking forward to it like Christmas morning, because it's so much fun to be with these people. And so it's an amazing community. And for those that say, yeah, that stuff makes sense to me, there's nothing else like it. And it's a fun place to be when you're in that kind of situation.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I was at base camp earlier this year speaking, and that was just an incredible experience. Well, I'll say this in wrapping up, you know, if you could, you know, get on the phone and talk to, I don't know, Grant Cardone or Ryan Serhant or something like that, as amazing as being able to talk to someone like that would be, although personally, Grant Cardone, I don't really have any desire to talk to the guy anyways. But you fill in the blank, whatever that is. I consider it really, and I'm blessed to be able to call you on the phone. And I would absolutely call you on the phone before I call any of these other guys, because you've got, like, literally you have been able to speak this into my life, into the lives of the kids you're working with. And I'm thinking, well, okay, my kids are how old and Unbound? Okay. Like, I want them hearing this at a formative age as soon as they can, and be able to hopefully bend the learning curve in their favor. So their old man, he didn't get it till, you know, kind of in his 30s or whatever. Maybe they can get it at 18. and the stuff, you know, you're this good now. Think of where you'll be 5 to 10 years from now, and the people you've brought into the program and the information you're able to share and more experience. So thank you for coming on. This is like a moment of I don't know how to necessarily express it. It was just, it's really neat to have this come full circle where, I mean, we were on a phone call, you know, almost 15 years ago. Hey, can I get the job? I got the job. Yay. To all that's transpired. Here we sit now. Who knows where it's going the next 15 years? I think it's going to be going some pretty cool places. So thank you. And I wish you the very best. And we'll do this again, because there's no reason to wait another 85 episodes to do this.
Well, it was super fun. It was such an honor to be here, John. It's so much fun to listen to the podcast. And I've gained some great stuff from it. I took some notes. I've spent a lot of money on books of people that have been on your podcast.
I'm sorry.
I'm not at all. No, it is a great investment. I've got one sitting over there that I'm reading. And I got another one on order just from, like, I'll be out like mowing the grass and have to stop the mower and write down, like, I need to order this book because you had a guest on. And so what a cool thing to be a part of this. And so thanks for having me. It's been an honor.
Awesome. Take care.